Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and in this episode, we're looking back at some of the highlights from podcasts we've made over the past 12 months. Today, we're focusing on healthy aging. It's a topic that comes up often on the podcast, and we'll start with a bit of scene setting. I spoke to Mike Hughes from FMCG Gurus for an episode we recorded in partnership with Beneo, and I started by asking him about the trends we're seeing in the health and wellness sector related to healthy aging.
One clear trend that we're seeing is consumers are looking to stay fitter and active until as late as life as possible, and break stereotypes associated with aging, adopting a forever young ethos. We know people are delaying traditional life cycles, breaking them up, doing things in later in life that they normally would have 10, 15, 20 years ago. One trend that I always like to see at the moment, I think it's a good indicator of how consumers associate aging, is when you see memes on social media where there's ridicule around what a 40-year-old, what a 50-year-old looked like in the 1980s, 1990s compared to now. You know, people deem themselves to be a lot younger physically and emotionally. At the same time, they do recognize that as they're getting older, there's increased vulnerability to disease and illness. They also recognize that there is that barrier between living till later in life and living a healthier life. You know, that's something that's we often see where people have seen their older relatives spend the last few years of their lives in relative discomfort, having an impact on quality of life and want to avoid that. So we're seeing this real focus on preventative health, particularly as, you know, people recognize that there's various challenges to staying fit and active until later in life. And, you know, some of these are out of their control. You know, there's macroeconomic issues related to price inflation, to uncertainty, that will impact on their stress, which will then impact on their blood pressure levels, for example, that they look to address and keep hold of. You know, I think one key group that is really important to discuss with this is Generation X, because they're kind of at that crossroads where they recognize that they're not old. They certainly don't feel old. They don't like to be reminded that they're getting older. But at the same time, they realize that they're not as younger as they used to be, and they need to start making those fundamental changes to their health and wellness. So, you know, look, 69% of consumers now are saying that they're taking this long-term approach to health. So it's not, you know, restricted to them, but I think it does show that good overlap. It shows that this is, you know, something that's applicable to all demographics, but I think, you know, we kind of need to start looking at those mid-age and older as like the key drivers of healthy aging. One other trend that we've also seen, and I think it's important to highlight, is that, you know, rising prices are having an influence on healthy aging, both in terms of, you know, potentially causing those feelings of stress, but, you know, also resulting in consumers taking that more considered approach to purchasing within the health and wellness market. You know, consumers, you know, are driven by value. So if they're going to go to turn to these products to help them live a healthier life, they need to believe these products are credible, which is why, for example, 57% of consumers in the UK say scientific evidence is important when purchasing products. But they want products that they know and trust, deem effective and essential, and, you know, are absolutely integral to helping maintain that good quality of life.
Well, we'll talk a bit more about the cost of living, because obviously it's such a huge issue. So we'll get onto that a bit later. It's interesting, though, what you were saying about Generation X, that people don't want to be told they're old, basically. It's quite hard to market products in that way, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's about having a positive message. And I think with any kind of health and wellness market, I think this is especially true for heart health, which we're going to discuss more. But I think you have to give it that aspirational positioning. You have to position products with breaking stereotypes rather than to conform into stereotypes, and really relaying messages around fun, vibrancy and energy, as opposed to kind of vulnerability to disease and illness.
Sure. Yeah. And are there specific areas that consumers are interested in or they're concerned about within healthy aging?
Yeah. Well, I mean, healthy aging obviously covers a wide variety of areas. And what's been really interesting over the last few years is, you know, the dynamics of what consumers are prioritizing has, you know, shifted and shifted several times. And obviously there's, you know, COVID a few years back had an influence on that. And thankfully what we're seeing now is this kind of return to normal. Consumers are still taking this proactive approach to health, you know, they're actively looking to stay fit and active. It's less driven by fear of illness as it was a few years ago, you know, where consumers aren't, you know, putting on the media every day and having all this negative news. And one of the things that we've kind of seen around this is consumers are taking this back to basic approach, and they're focusing on getting the core essentials right and saying, hey, you know what, you know, functional products are great. But at the same time, these products will only be effective if I get the absolute core essentials right. So that's one, basically having a healthy diet, getting the right amount of exercise, having the right amount of rest and recuperation. And it's focusing on the absolute core areas of health. And one area where it seems kind of been overlooked the last couple of years, because we've seen a lot of information around digestive health, around cognitive health, around immunity for obvious reasons, is heart health, you know, because it's at the center to everything. You know, consumers realize that if they don't have good heart health, you know, they're not going to have this good quality of life. And we see that, you know, consumers are prone to suffering things from hypertension, high blood pressure, high cholesterol levels. You know, 40% of consumers are researched in the showed last year in the UK and satisfied with their heart health. And that is such a big figure considering, you know, how fundamentally basic heart health is to overall wellness. You know, and 56% say that they're interested in heart health products even when not suffering from symptoms. You know, so we're seeing this real kind of focus on saying, actually, you know, of course areas like digestive health are important, of course cognitive health are important, but actually we need to get the absolute essentials right. And now that we can give this a bit more of a rational thought, because, you know, we're not outright driven by this fear of illness we were seeing a few years ago. Consumers are saying, actually, the heart's really central to everything. It's crucial to healthy aging. But then at the same time, there's various diet and lifestyle traits, you know, that are increasing the risk of heart health problems, ranging from, you know, not monitoring sugar intake, for instance, to not having structured dietary plans, to, you know, not getting enough exercise, you know, to even not having enough sleep health. So I think, you know, heart health is going to be a real core area over the next couple of years.
Okay, so what can we say about what's driving that then? What are the consumers telling us?
Yeah, well, I mean, the long-term answer is aging. You know, it's definitely a macro economic trend in that influence. And, you know, we see research where I think in the UK by 2050, I remember seeing a stat, something like there's going to be more grandparents than there are teenagers. You know, we know the number of people who've grown up are 80 plus continues to rise. And there's a kind of push and pull element there. You know, in one sense, consumers realize that they're not getting any younger. They'll have seen, you know, older relatives potentially have health problems that they want to avoid, and they want to break these stereotypes. At the other end, consumers realize that as society gets older, then things such as retirement plans have to get pushed back. So it's essential, you know, they also recognize that, you know, an aging population will have a pretty significant impact on the healthcare system in the UK, which many people feel is not suitable at the moment, and that will only put under more pressure. So, you know, aging is the long term. But consumers also realize that, you know, some of these health problems are, you know, self-inflicted. You know, again, just some of the research that we've seen over the last 12 months, 23% of consumers say that they're easily vulnerable to disease and illness, which, you know, to me suggests that one in four people believe that they're in poor health. It's kind of backed up with the fact that, you know, 17% also say that their dietary habits are poor. So, you know, whilst we hear a lot about consumers seeking out functional ingredients, you know, making sure that they avoid and moderate dietary evils, there's many consumers who are over-reliant on processed food, who don't monitor their micronutrient intake, who are prone to overindulging, who are prone to having poorly structured mealtime habits. You know, combine that with things such as busy lives, where consumers feel that they don't relax like they should. They're often believe that they spend too much time being inactive on digital devices. But there's a whole host of things where consumers are saying, actually, these are kind of small problems now, in the sense that, you know, they're not posing this immediate challenge, but actually long term, you know, if we keep on doing this, and actually this will have a significant influence long term, and it may not be reversible. So, you know, we know that consumers are looking to, you know, address these issues. You know, again, some of the research, 59% of consumers say that they're actively looking to improve their nutrition levels over the next 12 months. And I think, you know, that's fair to say, quite a lot of people aren't overly satisfied with their dietary habits. You know, the majority of people in the UK feel that they could be improved in certain ways. One third of consumers are actively trying to address high blood sugar levels, which again shows that many people are going, hey, you know, actually my lifestyle could be problematic in the long term. And they realize, again, whilst there's some inevitability around vulnerability to illness long term, they also realize that the diet and lifestyle that they lead are contributing to this in the long term. So we're actively looking to address this.
Well, some interesting insights there about the trends we're seeing in this market. But perhaps we should take a step back before we move forward. In October 2024, Food Matters Live held an event in Ascot with a whole panel discussion dedicated to the topic of nutrition and healthy aging. Jane Murphy, Professor of Nutrition at Bournemouth University, and Amanda Skiach from the Wolfson Institute of Population Health were the guests. And Hope Philip Calder from the University of Southampton was keen to ground the conversation with an agreed definition.
So I'm going to ask sort of, it might be an obvious, or it might sound a silly question. I'm going to ask Jane, what do we really mean by healthy aging?
Okay, really good question. And I think if I could just go back a step to sort of reflect on, in terms of our aging population, and as we all recognise, we're living longer, globally and in the UK, but that doesn't always translate into healthy life years. And I think that's a challenge that, you know, that we face, and to some extent why we're here for this session. And nutrition and food is one aspect that we have control over, that we can modify. So the challenge is to extend those healthy life years, that help healthy aging perspective. So people can live better lives, improve their quality of life, and, you know, in terms of measuring quality of life, there are different measures that we can use. But I think, you know, for me, it's those happy, healthy, light life years and maintaining that enjoyment around food. And that's something that's been brought to life with some of my research, working, you know, with older people in community, that, you know, it's very different, it's very diverse, but to maintain that engagement with food for as long as possible, given there's lots of other challenges, I think is really, really important. How we achieve that is not easy.
Thanks. Yeah. So I think it's important for us to talk a little bit about the challenges and then talk about possible solutions. There's challenges in terms of the individuals, the population, the people, but there's also challenges from the food and nutrition side. So maybe, Amanda, you could say something about what you see as the key challenges to healthy aging from the food and nutrition side.
That's a really interesting question. Trying to think where to start. The thoughts that are running through my head with that. I think, you know, older people have established eating patterns of whatever culture and type that is. And so they will be buying the foods that they've been used to be buying and cooking in the way that they're used to cooking largely. They're also generally the least digitally connected, and so maybe less aware of the new research that's available, even, you know, obviously in the popular press rather than in academic journals. And so they're almost the hardest to reach people. And so therefore the kind of ordinary everyday staple foods, it's really important that they are supporting good aging rather than harming people as they age. And 75% or so of, I can talk particularly about salt, of our Food in the UK comes from processed packaged food. That's not a bad thing necessarily, but it means that it's quite, it can be quite hidden unless you're a real reader of labels. And so the food industry, they obviously are aware and most striving to conform to the various targets around calories and sugar and salt, and doing a good job there in many places. But there's always a range. And so if you're picking up your particular sliced bread that you've had forever and that's higher in salt and lower in fibre, then you're not necessarily having the best foods for you. And while individual choice and responsibility is an important part of our diet, I think it's even more important that the choices on the shelves are as healthy as they could be, so that food companies are doing good rather than doing harm. And that's really difficult when you've got that tension of product quality, consumer acceptability, and price. But I think we do need a shift in the food system, and I would see that food companies have the power to do that and help people throughout the life course and as they age and are less connected to what those labels say.
So you touch on, I think, a few interesting interconnected points. And at the end, you mentioned price. So, you know, affordability, accessibility of whether a food is healthy or less, more or less healthy, are big issues with some older people for sure, as well as the food itself. So, Jane, what about, I'll call them, if you like, the physiological and psychological challenges of healthy aging in older people?
So we talked a lot about the healthy aging perspective and eating well, which is appropriate for most of us for most of our adult lives. But for older people, sometimes things might change for whatever reason, factors beyond their control. And that's maybe where we need to think differently, because I think the challenge is that it's not that one size fits all. And I suppose from a food manufacturer's point of view, when you're sort of targeting this market, who is old? Who is an older person? No one likes to think themselves as old. At, you know, what point do we become old? Is it 60? Is it 65? And then obviously things may change even more as we get older, and thinking about the needs that those older people sort of need. And then we need to consider obviously our changing population in terms of the demography. We have a growing diverse ethnic population as well. So I think we really need to focus more upon culture, and something that's come very through the strong with when the projects I'm involved with. And recognising that first-generation people from diverse ethnic communities want to retain their culture, but second-generation maybe are becoming more westernised, but still keeping aspects, you know, of their culture. So I think for me, it is a challenge. It's not one size fits all. We need to take, if we can, an individualised approach. But when we're sort of responding to the masses, I think we need to recognise. And people, I suppose, themselves need to take responsibility over their health and well-being, and make those appropriate choices, and recognising when things do change, what needs to happen. And it may be that that person needs to, you know, if, for example, they've lost their appetite, well, how do we ensure that that person meets their needs through consuming, you know, more protein, more quality protein, and maybe we'll come back to that, Philip, but also maintaining that nutrient density. And I think that's really the key thing here. How do we ensure that, you know, older people do maintain that nutrient sort of density with, you know, within food when their appetites are failing?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so what I realise is I've strayed the discussion into nutrition for older people, which is different from healthy ageing. So maybe we can think now more about what opportunities you see for promoting healthy aging, which is not necessarily getting the right nutrients into older people. So again, Amanda, I'll start with you. Opportunities, big opportunities nutritionally, diet-wise, for healthy aging.
Sorry, I'm just going to have to look down at my crib notes and see where that might be. I think one of the things that strikes me is the narrowing tracks or adjoining tracks of nutrition and pharmacology, really. And I think this awareness from food companies of ingredients that really can have a direct benefit. And I only came in on the end of the presentation, it was just here before, so I'm not highlighting, was it Benio particularly, but that's the sort of thing that I'm thinking of, that there are, we're learning more and more about how foods work and that really detailed impact on the body. So I think that's probably a really great opportunity there that the scientists and the food technologists are able to connect with research, to develop research around these very active ingredients and to include those. So you've got the kind of going into the, you know, much more the micro and detailed level, but you've also got coming up to the macro level of, you know, what is sensible eating and what is it that the medical committees have been saying for decades about less fat, less salt, less sugar, more fibre, and all those things that will help to keep us at a healthier weight and not have our blood pressure too raised. And cardiovascular disease is still the global leading killer, and it is a big, big problem in the UK. So I think, yeah, you've got the, what are your big easy ticks that we almost overlook, and plenty of processed food will be fulfilling a good HFSS profile, but some of it is not, too much of it isn't. So I think less of that on our shelves, reformulation from the companies, less of that in our baskets as we as consumers go round picking it up, so that we're not actually doing harm to ourselves in that way.
Yeah, thanks. It's amazing you've got a crib sheet, because I'm just making up the questions in real time as we go. So,
Fortunately, I do have a script in front of me to help take us to the next clip I'd like to highlight, and it's all about blueberries. Now, this episode with Dr. Jose Lara Gallegos from Northumbria University wasn't specifically about healthy aging, but the topic came up because of the suggestion they may have a role to play in preventing heart disease and dementia. Host Stephen Gates asked Dr. Gallegos about one of the key substances found in blueberries, antioxidants.
Is this a blanket application? Is a lot of antioxidants always a good thing?
No, this is an important aspect. There are positives, yes, but there is some evidence that high levels of antioxidants will lead or have also negative effects opposite to what it will be, oxidation, as we have been talking before. So I could not say that there is a specific level or cutoff where we are, you know, where things are good or bad. As I said before, we always talk about associations, risk, etc. So that we say, as we say at the beginning of this podcast, there might be side effects also whenever you go over over to what is the bill.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of fruits offer us lots of benefits, but let's be wary that you can always have too much of a good thing. Now, I'm sounding a little bit cynical about blueberries, which I'm not at all. I love blueberries, and I'm sure and they can be really positive things for your diet as well. So let's talk about the positive sides. There are some claims that they can help to protect against ill health. Is there any evidence in this area?
Yes. This is one of those areas in which growing evidence is growing. I should mention that perhaps the interest on the antioxidant effect and, you know, effects associated with blueberries consumption probably started in the late 90s. So in a way, it's fairly recent period in which we have been able to document this. However, we have some evidence coming from epidemiological population studies suggesting there is an association in which shows that if your consumption of blueberries and therefore anthocyanins is higher in relation with the average population or those at the bottom, you will have certain benefits. You will have a lower risk for a number of conditions. The most or the perhaps most studied is cardiovascular disease, probably because it is considered one or the two main causes of death worldwide. You know, cardiovascular disease and cancer normally go head to head on which is the main cause of deaths globally. So cardiovascular disease has been well documented because we see this association. If anything that improves or your cardiovascular health is likely to impact other aspects such as cognitive decline, dementia, as we probably will talk a little bit further. So there is evidence coming from that angle, population studies. That information normally will generate hypotheses that are going to be tested in randomized controlled trials in which we supplement either blueberries or blueberry extracts or supplements of anthocyanins to people and follow them, you know, see what effects may have. And from this other side of the evidence, we also have we have been able to document that consuming blueberries or increasing our consumption of anthocyanins and other phenolic compounds may be associated with reduction of cardiovascular risk factors, for example. And consequently, you know, that supports the hypothesis that we may prevent diseases. As I said before, it will be very difficult to prove cause and effect because it will take years.
And nutritional studies are so complex anyway.
And expensive, yeah. That's another thing.
Okay, you mentioned connections with dementia. So let's talk a little bit about brain health. What are the known links between either blueberries or anthocyanins and cognitive function?
Yes, well, as I mentioned before, because dementia has a very strong link with what is cardiovascular health or vascular health, very strong link there. Anything that is positive or has a positive effect on your vascular health is likely to impact on dementia. So obviously that gave origin to the idea, the hypothesis to test what is the link between these two. And we have, when we evaluate the evidence, it's important to separate the epidemiological studies showing an association, but still, you know, very important studies because they have large amount number of people, large sample sizes. So those studies suggest that, again, the more blueberries and anthocyanins you consume in your diet, the lower the risk for certain dementia. It's not a single term, Alzheimer's and other related problems. It may be reduced around by around 40%. We are talking about studies that follow people over, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. So that is one side of the, or one piece of evidence. Nowadays, we have, again, randomized controlled trials supplementing either blueberries or blueberry supplements, extracts to people. And just as I mentioned before, the impact on cardiovascular risk factors such as blood pressure or cholesterol and, of course, cardiovascular diseases. In this case, those studies of randomized controlled trials have focused on some dimensions of what is cognitive function, memory, executive function, and there has been an association findings supporting the fact that consuming blueberries may improve some aspects of memory. Memory is not a single domain. It's actually quite complex for people who is not or doesn't have a psychological background like myself. But in terms of short memory, executive function, aspects like that have been improved in those clinical trials. If it improves that cognitive function, it's likely then to reduce that cognitive decline that it occurs with age before dementia or dementias appear. So there is again growing evidence, but these studies are more recent, so we need more research, no doubt about that, to really confirm and expand on what is the.
Yeah, and again, you mentioned it's an association. There's no causal link yet.
We cannot confirm that because, again, when you do an evaluation of the evidence, you need to consider studies that show positive effects and those that show negative effects. And then, taken together, try to do an evaluation on in which direction truly the evidence goes and which weight more than the others. So often we, particularly in the media, and is, you know, this is the way that we reach the public, sometimes we come across a new recent study publishing positive results, and then, you know, we come with those messages like, superfoods,
yeah, and it joins the body of us, and that doesn't mean that this research is irrelevant. You know, observational studies are still important anyway.
But so, you know, for example, one of our own studies, a recent short-term trial, showed no effect.
So blueberries could be one to watch, but how else can we use nutrition to look after our health as we grow older? Well, we're back on the road, and this time in London for the Food Matters Live Inspiring Nutrition event. Harriet Smith from HRS Communications and Claire Hughes from Sainsbury's were the guests, and the conversation turned to fortification and claims on packaging.
Going on to Harriet, we're talking about... you've got some expertise on fortification and organic and clean label, and you obviously write a lot about that, so you must understand it. What would you say the right balance is between those three issues?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And certainly we work with a lot of food and supplement companies at HRS who may come to us before they've even established their product, or perhaps they're further down the line and they have a product and they're looking at how to position that in the market and communicate to consumers. So in terms of fortification, we're all about optimizing the nutritional content of that product versus clean labeling or organic, which I think consumers generally take to mean natural and minimal processing. So certainly targeted fortification here is important. So looking at your population. So in the UK, for example, we know that there are certain nutrients that are commonly deficient, like vitamin D, for example. So being strategic in how you're tackling that, and perhaps looking at the different demographics. So today, obviously, we're talking about healthy aging. So perhaps looking at an older population, what are the nutrients of concern there and how can you address that through your product? I think you have to be careful as a brand not to just put lots of ingredients in for the sake of it, like you were saying, Viv, in terms of the health and nutrition claims that you can make about that product. Consumers are wanting transparency. So there's a big gap, I think, for education of consumers and explaining to them why you've put those nutrients or why you've fortified a product and how that can align with their health and nutrition goals. I think careful of alignment with suppliers is important. So making sure that you're working with reputable suppliers if you're looking for organic ingredients, for example, or even looking to see if you can use natural whole foods as a means of improving the nutritional content of that product. And then finally, certification. So, you know, if it's an organic product, looking at ways you can get that product verified and certified to build that trust with the consumer is important.
Mm. Yes, good. And do you think the public understands certification? Probably the Organic Society, they would understand. Are there any other certified bodies which might appear on the label?
I think that's a great point. And I don't have the answer to that, but I think including consumers in the early market, in the early kind of ideation stage is important. So asking them those questions, does certification matter to you? Mm. What kinds of certifications would you be looking for to make sure that you're really tapping into that? One thing to bear in mind, today, obviously many of us are from science, nutrition and food backgrounds, and there's a wealth of knowledge in the room. But when you step outside of this room, the average consumer's reading age is about 11 years old, if not lower. So we've got to remember that in terms of how we're educating and speaking to the consumer, making sure that we're translating that information into very easy to understand messages that are accessible to a lay audience is important too. Hmm.
I'm sorry to sort of go off track. I mean, we're worried in oncology about iodine deficiency, actually. Now, iodine, as you know, used to be in flour, correct me if I'm wrong, and table salt. You can still buy it in table salt, but it's not sort of, it's not added legally. So I'm very worried about iron deficiency. But what, how do the public feel if they say we've added it as on a population basis? Maybe for yourself. So, you know, do they feel they're being hoodwinked? Say, well, you know, there's a big daddy theory that we're all, you know, I might get enough iodine, so why am I having to have it as a fortification? But yet the 90% of the population are heading for deficiency and we're all going to get goiters again. So where's the balance there in fortification?
I think there is a balance because I don't think people know that there's certain products that have already been fortified. So bread and flour is fortified in the UK. I don't think people know that. And they only know because a labelling change in the regulation meant that you had to list it out in the back of packs. So some things that have happened for a long time, people don't know. Although it's broadly accepted in cereals that you have fortification. Mm. I think that in the case of folic acid, and I know that they've been in and out and I've not followed it, but there was lots about whether you fortify the flour or not. And it benefits a large proportion of the population, but not everyone that has the bread. So it's an interesting one because you'll have people that don't want it and maybe it's about choice. The problem is when you give choice, you then don't target all the people that you want because they can choose to opt out. And it actually makes it more complicated for suppliers because if you're handling lots of different flour or an ingredient where you haven't had lots of different nutrients in it, it just adds complexity into that manufacture process. So I think if it's the right thing to do and it comes back to the science, for me, the science has to be there for fortification. Vitamin D, I have done that in a previous role where I fortified a product with vitamin D. We brought it into the bread at a certain level and made sure, and that was done in conjunction with a university looking at the research to make sure it was the right thing and it didn't cause complications. But I think if it needs to come independently and trusted, so I'm not sure. Yeah.
Okay. Do you think vitamin B1 should be in beer?
Vitamin.
That was an Australian innovation where the more beer you had, you're more likely to be vitamin B1. So it's actually a self-fulfilling prophecy. So just put it in the targeted, the beer. But never got through, but I thought it was a good idea.
I don't think it'd get through. In the, you're not allowed to actually, from a regulation, actually, you wouldn't be able to talk about it, yeah.
But, okay, yeah. We'd have to go through Parliament, you think?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, good. So as a researcher myself, we're doing several studies at the moment, one on a phytochemical-rich supplement, one on probiotics with vitamin D added. Where do you think obviously we deal more on symptoms recovering from cancer, so lethargy, joint pains, menopausal symptoms, COVID, preventing COVID. So where do you think we should be looking as researchers? Maybe yourself, Harriet, so because you're on the sort of, you write a lot on research. So where should we be concentrating on nutritional research going forward?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think certainly all these non-communicable diseases, like you mentioned, and in fact, I was just speaking to someone earlier outside and they were saying how Alzheimer's is now being described as the new type 3 diabetes. And, you know, there's a lot we can be doing now to hopefully reduce our risk of developing these conditions later in life. So I think, you know, really this piece of education that we talked about earlier and bringing it to the forefront of people's minds, that they have this opportunity to potentially reduce their risk of a number of lifestyle diseases through good nutrition and lifestyle is really important. And anything that brands and retailers can do to make that easier and more accessible for everyone is crucial.
So Alzheimer's number one, you said. I mean, that is probably what we're all heading for, isn't it? Or some form of memory or cognitive dysfunction, I think, if we already haven't had it. So on that front, so you are obviously waiting patiently. Should we open up to the audience? There must be some questions. There's a question. Is there a microphone?
Yes, hello. I was just wondering about how we connect up the sort of ingredients aspect with the sort of public health aspect, really. And Robert was mentioning this fact that we had fortification for a long time for certain things to prevent certain, you know, public health issues. So if we needed to prioritize according, say, the major public health threats, which are the usual non-communicable diseases, heart attacks, diabetes, obesity, cancer, obviously, wouldn't there be sort of the need to look into certain priority areas with respect to ingredients? I think of, for example, anti-inflammatories, and go about this in a more systematic way, with the aim to promote public health more broadly. And then the ingredients would be, you know, the ones we think are good ingredients, for example, to prevent inflammation, which would be reducing a number of diseases and would prevent, you know, increase longevity in the long term.
Excellent question. I think ingredients to reduce inflammation would be tricky, apart from, you know, the colourful foods, making sure people have more of a rainbow diet and good gut health. But are there any, Claire, would you say, is there any sort of foods which would target inflammatory ingredients apart from whole fruit and veg?
I think it's a whole diet approach. Well, it would be for me that would, and I think there are ingredients as part of that, but it'd be quite difficult, I think, to substantiate them on their own, because you'd want the whole, you'd want an anti-inflammatory based diet, which I think is interesting how you get back to customers to eat that almost 80% of the time. So yeah, I think, I mean, I'm also not only for brain health, I've always been quite an advocate of omega-3, and I've tried to, over the years, failed quite a bit actually to fortify, to get rebalance that in products, but quite often it comes through as a taint and the customer can take it, so they don't buy the product again. But there's a whole, what you were saying about herbs, there's quite a lot of evidence for some of the herbs and anti-inflammatory and how you incorporate them just in meals, I think, in cooking.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. We've got some exciting news to share about more live events in 2025. We're heading to Ascot in April, Manchester in May, and Dublin in November. And for the first time, we're hosting an event in mainland Europe. In September 2025, we'll be in Rotterdam. Join us as we inspire the future of food. Learn more and sign up at foodmatterslive.com, and we look forward to seeing you there.